People who have never touched a patient in their lives are making laws about how I practice medicine.
Welcome to a very special election edition of Off the Chart with Medical Economics, a podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices. I'm your host, Keith Reynolds, and just like everyone else, we here at Medical Economics are looking forward to the election results to see what the future holds for our nation. But rather than just wait to see which direction the country may take, many physicians across the country have chosen to get more involved in shaping policy by running for office themselves. Today, we'll take a look at what this actually entails as we present our Physician's Guide to Running for Office. This is a companion piece to the wonderful print feature by Medical Economics editor Richard Payerchin that ran back in September. What you're about to hear has been pulled from the hours of interviews he performed with physicians serving in government at the local, state, and federal level.
Running for office as a physician is always difficult.
Dr. Jasmine Baines is a member of the California State Assembly who says there are lots of reasons physicians may stay away from politics.
You know, politics can get ugly. You're worried about your image as a physician. You're worried about, you know, what your patients would think about you. Anybody can pretty much say anything about you in the press, and the press can go ahead and say it. So there's that concern, how it's going to impact your own family, your own personal life. And physicians, you know, we work quite a bit. You know, we are working around the clock. So that little bit of time that we have for personal time, we want to protect. And is politics the right place to protect that little bit of personal time that we get? So it's a big commitment. It's a big commitment for specifically a physician to want to run for office.
Dr. Baines was particularly hesitant to run, saying it took her being asked 21 times before she agreed. On the other end of the spectrum, Dr. Ken Moore, mayor of Franklin, Tennessee, says he always liked politics and was relatively easy to persuade to throw his hat into the ring.
Somebody asked me one day, and, you know, it just hit me at the right moment, and or maybe the wrong moment, and I said, yep, I think I will. So it wasn't a long, steady decision. It was pretty knee-jerk reaction that I decided I would run. And I never really, you know, I had people say, well, you ought to run for mayor. I said, we've got a good mayor. So, you know, how things happen sometimes. Things just, you know.
Dr. Elizabeth Steiner, an Oregon state senator running for state treasurer, got her start in advocacy before realizing the legislature had a need for a physician's voice.
And the more I was involved with that, the more I realized two things. The first is that many legislators are like physicians. They tend to subspecialize, right? There's somebody who's interested in education or public safety issues or environmental issues or take your pick. But most legislators have little or no understanding of the health system and of what's important to their constituents to help them stay healthy, right? So that's the first thing. And very few doctors, relatively speaking, run for public office. And the second thing I realized was that, well, most of us know that only about 10% of what we consider health happens in a traditional healthcare setting. The vast majority of it is either genetics, which is a small part, or social determinants of health, like poverty and housing and food security and education and a whole bunch of other things, right? And furthermore, as a family physician, I'm trained to look at the world in a very matrixed way, right? Education is connected to healthcare, which is connected to economic development, which is connected to the environment. And most people don't really look at the world that way. They don't see the connections. So when I had the opportunity, when my then state senator, when people started to encourage me to run, and then my state senator, when she and I were talking about whether she was going to run for Congress, and then she encouraged me to run, I thought, you know, maybe there's something here. And maybe I could bring that matrixed worldview and that understanding of upstream public health and upstream individual health to the legislature and offer something to the state. So that's what got me here.
Dr. Alice Mann, a Minnesota state senator, said that concern for her patients is what started her first run and why she decided to come back after leaving office.
So I decided to run for office in 2018, and I won a seat in the Minnesota House, where I served for 2 years. A lot of my work was on healthcare reform. That's, why I ran for office in the first place. My days were becoming really quite a struggle, very disappointing, as my patients needed medications and treatments, and therapies that I would get called invariably every single day, with them telling me I can't afford it, insurance won't cover it, I don't know what to do. And so I thought there has to be something else that can be done. I feel like I'm working in a system that keeps putting up barriers in front of patient care. And so I ran for office. In 2020, I decided to not run for re-election. It was the middle of COVID. I was working in the ER, and we were getting just bombarded in the ER. I mean, as many people know, I was watching three people die every shift, which is completely unheard of. And so I thought someone can replace me in the Minnesota House, but we don't have extra physicians lying around to replace me in the ER. So I decided not to run again. And quite frankly, I don't really like politics. I don't enjoy politics. I like the policy part. I like solving problems, but I didn't enjoy politics. And so I was okay stepping back and not running for re-election. And then in 2022, we redistricted, and all of a sudden, I was sitting in a district without a senator. And so my phone rang about 30 times that day, asking me to go ahead and run. And so I said yes, and I ran again, and now I'm in the Senate.
Dr. Ami Berra is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from California. He said he got into politics to make sure physicians had a seat at the table during the drafting of the Affordable Care Act.
I had never run for office before, and when I decided to run in 2010, it was on the heels of President Obama getting elected, and I knew he was going to work on healthcare. So it's like I could sit on the sidelines, or I could try to get in the game and shape what this looks like. So that was a big learning curve.
Dr. Michael Burgess, also a member of the House of Representatives from Texas, says his choice to run was influenced by the greatest geopolitical factor of the time.
Well, for me, it was 9/11 and the events surrounding 9/11. It was really pretty jarring, of course, as you remember. Caused me to ask, was I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, or should I perhaps be doing something else? I was in my early 50s at the time, had a really big practice as an OBGYN. I stopped taking new OB patients about 2 years prior, but I still took a call from my group.
Whatever the reason, once a physician declares their candidacy, the race is on, which means campaigning and fundraising. Some physicians have a background that makes fundraising easy, like Dr. Baines in California, who worked in her family's car dealership before becoming a doctor. But some physicians are put off by the necessity of fundraising, like Dr. Kim Schreier, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from the state of Washington.
So I decided I was going to do this to save healthcare, but I knew I needed to know a lot more. And so I decided, and of course, I come from a tradition of studying and learning and wanting depth of understanding, that I needed to learn every world leader, master all history and geography. I needed a deep lesson in micro and macro economics, foreign policy research. And my team, who is charged with getting me elected, wanted me to sit on the phone and ask people for money to support my campaign. And I've never asked really for anything in my life. I mean, even with my parents, I was pretty timid about asking for things. And so it was very weird to call people with a, they weren't sending money to me. They were sending money to the cause that I represented for them and the difference I could make in Congress, right? So we had common goals, but I really felt like I was spinning my wheels and wasting my time. And so I went to my team and was like, what are we doing here? Like, this is crazy. I need to be studying up, so I'm good at this job. And they said, nobody is going to know what you think or how much you know if you can't afford to say it to them.
Dr. Steiner in Oregon says that campaigning is rough, but it gives her a chance to get out into her community and interact with constituents.
So campaigning is kind of a slog sometimes, and requires a willingness to do a bunch of stuff you don't like and do it cheerfully. My least favorite part of campaigning is raising money, but it's a necessary evil. So I've gotten good at that. And what I do like is getting out around my district, or now around the state as I run for state treasurer, to meet people, to hear what concerns them, to think about ways to solve problems that will benefit lots of people across the state. That's exciting, right? And I do that both as part of my official work, excuse me, and as part of campaigns.
American politics being what it is, political campaigns are bound to go negative, and nearly every elected official can give you an example. Dr. Bill Hauter, a member of the Illinois House of Representatives, saw negative attacks from his own party during the primary, despite his opponent being a friend.
It's interesting because I was, my district is a very conservative district, okay? So I don't have a lot of opposition from the opposing party in the general election, but in the primary, we had a, you know, my first, you know, election, we had a 3-person primary, and one of those was ultimately kicked off from a petition challenge. And then it was me against my Republican opponent. A lady who had been a longtime treasurer of my county. I'd worked with her for a long time and consider her a very good colleague and friend, but we were opponents, and she was backed by more of the establishment in our party because she was a longtime name and I was a newcomer, and they didn't know much about me. And so it was kind of interesting. There was attack ad that I wasn't a true Republican, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't truly a person that, you know, they used Trump a lot. They used the old Facebook posts that I had been critical of Trump or this or that. And they said I wasn't, you know, I couldn't be counted on to be a true Republican or to be to back Trump. And so it was interesting, and I kind of just let it, you know, I think it was ineffective, really, in my district. I think people got turned off to that because I had a lot of connections in my district, and people knew I was a conservative person, and they knew I was a reasonable person. I was a physician, and I just had a lot of family, friends, coworkers, neighbors, you know, church members of my church, so many extended family and so many connections. I had physicians that are in my family that are physicians in counties in my district. So I think people just, especially when you're talking about a Republican primary, which is self-selects for a certain person, and that's a person who usually is a very motivated voter and also is a very informed voter. And so I think negative attacks and on someone who it just rings hollow.
Dr. Mann in Minnesota said that her experience with these negative campaign practices has given her a better view on the reality of political messaging.
So when I first ran for the House, there were mailers out with my picture on it, and what they do is they have someone follow you around and take a picture of you when you look your worst, like when you leave the gym or, you know, you're all sweaty at a parade or something. So a sweaty face on a mailer that said, you know, I voted for a $90 million building upgrade while my constituents went hungry or something, right? I had never been in office. I had never voted for anything. Another one said that I supported Al-Qaeda. Another one said that I supported other Islamic terrorists, and there was a picture of tombstones and guns and my face. There was one that said, I supported giving away your tax money to dead people. So all sorts of really bizarre, crazy things. But yes, attack ads are very real. And it also, you know, I was never involved in politics. I never wanted to be involved in politics. But it gave me this learning insight that I never knew, that the attack ads that you see on people are wildly false, right? I thought, well, there must be some kernel of truth to some of these things you get in the mail. No, they don't have to have any kernels of truth whatsoever. And so that was a really good learning experience for me going forward.
Oh, you say you're a practice leader or administrator? We've got just the thing. Our sister site, physicianspractice.com, your one-stop shop for all the expert tips and tricks that will get your practice really humming. Again, that's physicianspractice.com. So you've decided to run, you've fundraised, you've campaigned, you've done everything you can to push yourself over the finish line. But what if you don't make it? Dr. Bear of California found himself in that position when he first ran in 2010, but he says it wasn't a surprise.
You know, and if I'm being perfectly honest, probably 2 weeks out or so, I knew we were probably not going to win. There's a great This American Life, if you listen to that radio program or podcast, about our 2010 congressional race. It was the first year of Citizens United. And you know, we got really close. And then toward the end of the race, a big bolus of money came in against us and really drove us back. So I actually felt like we won on every metric. It was great to just see the number of folks that came out to volunteer on a campaign and, you know, outside of votes cast. And so, you know, I thought it was a pretty thrilling experience. Certainly, I would have liked to have won, but 2010 was a tough year to be a Democrat running for office. And, you know, I had no hesitation about knowing that I wanted to run again in 2012.
Dr. Schreier in Washington says that she doesn't necessarily trust the numbers on election night, but she respects what the votes cast for her represent in the minds of her constituents.
Well, I always look at them with a bit of caution because over time in a state where pretty much all ballots are mail-in, those numbers can fluctuate a little bit and they're always close. But, you know, it feels like the skills of a physician, being able to connect with people, to build trust, to work together, I feel like those same skills serve me in my current role of serving a district, helping people one at a time or in aggregate, listening to problems, taking them to Congress, passing legislation. And so I feel like over time, you know, maybe at first it was just the biography of being a pediatrician who cared about people's healthcare, but now it's really a broader sense, I think, that, oh yeah, we can trust her and she is going to bat for us. And she's proving that she did do all the things she said in 2018. And I think that just the longer that I'm in, the more people know me. They know I'm in their neighborhoods all the time.
We all know that politicians make and enforce the laws. But now that you're in office, the question is, what do you do all day? Here's what Dr. Barra of California says his day-to-day is like in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yeah, so we're usually in session Monday through Thursday or Tuesday through Friday. So I'm out in California, so that entails a lot of long flights. Yeah, if we're in session Monday, I'll usually be on a 5 a.m. flight, which means I'm getting up at 3 in the morning. You get on that flight, you get into Washington, D.C., 3:30. Usually head to our place in D.C., take a quick shower, get dressed, head up to the Hill, have meetings with my staff, go through what the schedule for that week looks like, talk about what legislation we might see coming to the floor. I've got committee hearings and things like that. So a regular day then starts the following day, usually at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. I try to go work out before getting to the Hill. Doesn't happen every day. And then the day just continues with hearings, votes. I'm on the intelligence committee, so often we're down in the classified area getting briefed on things, and that does take a lot of time. And then you know, you may have late night votes. This past week we had votes that happened at 9 o'clock at night. So you might go off to your evening events and then come back to the Hill. In general, though, we're finished with votes around 5 or 6 o'clock, and then usually folks will have 1 or 2, 3 events that evening, and you'll kind of jump through those. I'm trying to limit the number of events because you know, it's really easy to sit there and eat junk food and hors d'oeuvres and have a glass of wine or two, and then next thing you know, you're 10 or 15 pounds heavier than when you got to Congress.
Being in the State House doesn't seem any easier. Dr. Steiner of Oregon says that when the legislature is in session, her days are filled with lawmaking and her evenings are spent bridging the divide with Republican colleagues.
My day-to-day routine depends a little bit on whether we're in legislative session or not. When we are in session, I'm usually in the office at 7:30 in the morning and I leave at 6 or 6:30 at night. And during that time, I am, for me, in meetings with my staff team. I start every day with a team meeting with my staff to make sure we're all running on the same page here. And then I have long blocks of time working with the legislative fiscal staff, working on budget issues. I have caucus time when I'm meeting with the other, in my case, Senate Democrats. We have floor sessions when we're on the floor voting on bills. I might have a committee. I have meetings with stakeholders of one kind or another. And then often after I'm done with the formal part of work, you mentioned living far away from the Capitol. I'm about an hour from the state capitol. It's not terrible. And many of my colleagues who live about the same distance commute every day. I tend not to, partly because I have really long days and adding 2 hours of commute time means I'm not exercising. I'm not, you know, getting enough sleep, all the things that I need to do to stay healthy. Additionally, relationships are important. So oftentimes when we're in session, I'll go out to dinner after work with one of my colleagues, often one of my Republican colleagues in the House or Senate, so that I can build relationships. Because when you get to know somebody as a real person, it's much easier to work together to find common ground on things that are going to benefit many people.
Some elected offices are considered full-time careers, but many aren't. Dr. Mann sees her role in the Minnesota State House as full-time, just like her role in the emergency room.
Yeah, so it's considered a part-time job, but I think with my type A personality, and I think a lot of doctors are the same way, it's a full-time job for me. We are in session January through May, and the rest of the year, I am in the office once or twice a week. I meet with constituents regularly. I attend events. You know, you get invited to organizations or businesses or nursing homes in your district. You give town halls where you talk to people about the work that's being done, and you start working on bills for next year. In fact, right before this, I had a meeting about bills for next year, and the staff that works on writing the bill said, well, I can write multiple bills because no one has come ask me for bills yet. They come in December and January and February, and then all of a sudden I'm swamped with bills to write. So I take it as a full-time job. I take it very seriously, obviously. But I also work full-time in the hospital. So during session, I will legislate Monday through Thursday, usually, and then I'll be in the ER on the weekends. And then when we're not in session, summer and fall, I go back to the ER.
And how does she find time to do it?
I don't sleep. I've given up on the notion of sleep. Just kidding. I have a very supportive family, and I include my family in my activities as much as I can. So they go door knocking with me. We walk the streets of our district together. They come to the office. You know, I had a drying station for them with markers and papers so they can hang out here. So we, you know, like, people ask me that a lot. Where do you find the time? And the answer simply is, if it's important, you will find the time.
And speaking of making time, what will become of your practice when you're in office? For Dr. Baines in California, maintaining her relationship with her patients and community is key to her work as a lawmaker.
So the first year as in office, I would keep coming back on the weekends. Monday through Thursday, I'm in Sacramento. And then I was coming back, you know, I would drive back, which I'm in a really rural part of California. So it's a 5-hour drive from Sacramento to get back here. And then I would, you know, come back. I was a medical director of recovery services for people in recovery from addiction. So I would usually come back Thursday evenings. I would go to the rehab, check in on things Fridays into the clinic or Friday into in the office. And then Saturday I would be in the clinic and then Sunday I would drive back. But as you can tell, the toll takes. So this year I've kind of adjusted a few things and I'm no longer the medical director of the rehab, but I'm still working in the clinic. And I usually do that when I'm back on break. So last Christmas, I cover all the holiday hours, give a break to the nurse practitioner and the PA that are there working in the urgent care. And that's really important for me because it's my ear to the ground on things that are affecting the community.
Dr. Howder in Illinois says the time constraint of being an elected official is what's probably keeping many physicians away from seeking office, but it's worth it to get physician voices heard.
I've had so many people say to me, how can you do this? How can you do both? And I just feel like, how can I not? When I see what all needs to be done and how we need to be represented in the General Assembly, and I just feel like we need as physicians, we really need to start making time because our voice needs to be heard, our perspective needs to be represented down in our state capitol. So I feel like we as physicians, and it's hard because it's getting harder because I think the feeling is it's advocacy as part of your career. It's so hard because it takes so much time and it's not our expertise. And we have a big, important, challenging job. We all do. We all have something that takes all of us really committed to our patients and to continually learning and doing, you know, the reading and the practice of your practice. And so I know it's hard, but we really were needed in our state capitals and we're wanted definitely in our state capitals. And we have to make the time.
Say, Keith, this is all well and good, but what if someone is looking for more clinical information?
Oh, then they want to check out our sister site, patientcareonline.com, the leading clinical resource for primary care physicians. Again, that's patientcareonline.com. Partisan disagreements seem as American as apple pie, but the tension between sides can impair even the best elected officials from accomplishing their agenda. While doctors tend to be a rather collegial group, Dr. Burgess of Texas says the physicians in Congress are by no means a monolith.
Oh, no. In fact, even physicians, other Republican physicians and I don't agree on everything, and we all, we're doctors. We got pretty... we're pretty rigid sometimes when we decide what we believe and what we think. So that's not at all uncommon. Just as with any other profession, we have a pretty active doctors' caucus in Congress. I'm one of three co-chairs. That's worked out well to have three of us involved in the leadership of that. There are times it is generally Republicans who attend the meetings, but there are times we do special outreach to our Democratic counterparts.
While the two sides usually don't agree, Dr. Schreier from Washington says that doctoral camaraderie comes in handy when reaching across the aisle.
some of my favorite partners in both parties are physicians, because we speak a common language. We all did residency. We all had practices of one sort or another. And so we work together, even though we may disagree on plenty of issues. We all bring that spirit of a physician, listening, finding our common ground, working together for the greater good. And so we've worked together on things like vaccinations for children, bumping up the Medicare physician reimbursement rates, making sure that physician researchers can access Medicare data to do that research, getting fruits and vegetables more prominently in some of our food programs like WIC. So we work together on a lot, and it's been a really good way to really bring back a lot of bipartisanship, which is exactly what the Congress and our country needs and deserves.
Some of the tension between politicians is over who gets credit for what and how decisions made in office affect one's reelection prospects. Dr. Howder of Illinois doesn't see his role that way.
There is a lot of pressure on people that want to make this a career and they want to be career politicians, and that's not my desire. And so, you know, who gets credit for passing the bill and whose name on it isn't that big of a deal for me. And, you know, Rick, I just feel like that gives me a ton of freedom to be a citizen legislator with my life and my livelihood and my home and everything is back in my district. It's I don't care if I get reelected. In fact, you know, this may sound bad, but if I don't get reelected, my life is better. Okay. So I'm doing this because I feel a real commitment to it. I feel a real desire to do this for a temporary period of time and make an impact temporarily. But I've continued to practice. And I think that just gives me so much freedom because I don't have to, I'm not dependent on the salary. I'm not dependent on the stepping stone of getting me higher, and that this is not a stepping stone to get me a higher office. And so it just feels like so freeing that I can say what I feel, I can vote how I feel. And I feel like a lot of politicians that are career politicians are a little bit bound by that desire.
So that's what it takes to get elected and to do the job when you get there. But what would any conversation with a doctor be without some advice? And let me tell you, these physician politicians have a lot of it to give. Dr. Steiner of Oregon recommends finding out exactly what you have in store for you if you win before you even declare.
I think it's really important to understand that being a legislator requires a lot of patience and a lot of tenacity. And you have to be prepared to be disappointed a lot.
But a theme we kept hearing from all our interview subjects takes us back to the beginning of our guide.
Try to figure out why you want to run.
Focus on your why. Remember why you authentically are getting into this race.
Be clear on your motivations.
I think it's really important to understand why you're doing it.
But even if you decide that running for office isn't for you, it's important to be involved or at least informed about what's going on politically. Dr. Mann of Minnesota notes that legislatures are taking a more active role in regulating the act of providing care.
Medicine and politics are completely intertwined now. They are one and the same. The care that I provide for my patients has a direct correlation to what's going on in local and federal politics. People who have never touched a patient in their lives are making laws about how I practice medicine. And if we don't become more involved, the system is just going to get worse and worse. Because again, if you've never touched the patient, you have no idea what steps are necessary and what your day-to-day looks like and what things need to be done to provide the best patient care. And so I always, every time I have a chance, I encourage physicians to please get involved. And that doesn't mean that you have to run for office. It just means that you have to perhaps call your representative or call your state senator.
Thank you.
And that concludes this special Election Week episode of Off the Chart with Medical Economics. We'd like to give our thanks to all the physician politicians who spoke to us for this episode, and a special thanks to Medical Economics editor Richard Payerchin, whose reporting was key to this endeavor. You'll find links to his featured report in the show notes. My name is Keith Reynolds, and on behalf of the whole Medical Economics team, I'd like to thank you for listening and ask that you please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, if you'd like a digest of the best stories Medical Economics publishes delivered straight to your email 6 days a week, subscribe to our newsletter at medicaleconomics.com. Medical Economics, Physicians Practice, and Patient Care Online are all members of the MJH Life Sciences family. Thank you, and don't forget to vote.